I think that I should mention first of all that our classes in the evenings through the week are going to be a consideration of the Sermon on the Mount. So if you weren't here yesterday, you're getting in somewhere near the middle, but I don't think that would be a serious disadvantage. We plan tonight and Wednesday through Friday nights to cover the rest of Matthew chapters 5 through 7, the entire Sermon on the Mount of Jesus. And we talked yesterday about how the Sermon on the Mount is the proclamation of Jesus, the King. The new King is laying down his law so that those who want to be a part of his kingdom will understand the requirements that are being placed upon them. So we're continuing through Matthew chapter 5 then with that in mind. And particularly we want to discuss those verses that were read just a few moments ago. But I think that yesterday evening we managed to skimp a bit on verses 13 through 16. So let me look at those for just a moment, and then we'll get into verse 17 and from there on. I closed the class yesterday by saying that those eight blessings, commonly called the Beatitudes, in verses 3 through 8, conclude with the greatest blessing, apparently, the culmination of all the others, which is in verse 10 through verse 12, blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And I'll just mention it once again, because it's the lead-in to verses 13 through 16, that what makes this final blessing, the greatest blessing, is that most of the others can be developed more or less in a vacuum by an individual working with his own character. But the only way that any of us are going to come close to being persecuted, whether it be verbally or physically, is if we're willing to stand up for what we believe. And so Jesus leaves this to the last as if to say, that final blessing that will perfect your faith, as described in the earlier Beatitudes, will be if you develop the courage or the faith, and I think those two words should be used interchangeably, to speak out to others of those things which you believe. And obviously this can invite persecution, and we use that in a rather broad sense, because very few of us, I think, have faced physical threats. But it can involve persecution in the broader sense of bringing trials and difficulties upon us, the loss of friends, the loss of positions perhaps because of the things which we have to hold to and believe and make a public stand for. But Jesus says this is necessary, that it is necessary to speak publicly of those things which you believe and thereby solidify or complete your faith in all of these other particulars. And I mention that again because it does provide the rationale for verses 13 through 16, and therefore verses 13 through 16 support what I just said. So notice in verse 13 we read that Jesus continues. He has made this eighth blessing, beginning with verse 10, a very personal blessing. Notice verse 11, for example. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and say all manner of evil against you falsely. He's personalized it very much. And so he continues in verse 13, developing that theme, when he says, ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt have lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It being the earth. Wherewith, or with what, will the earth be salted or preserved? Because salt is used in the Bible continuously as a symbol of a preservative, a protection, an antiseptic sort of idea, to preserve, to protect, and to cleanse. So Jesus says, you who are listening to me and who are following my commandments are the salt of the earth, the ones through whom the earth will or might be preserved. But if the salt has lost its savor, its distinctiveness which makes it salt, then with what will the earth be salted? In other words, in a rather symbolic way, what Jesus is saying is, if men are going to learn anything about God, they're going to have to learn about God from you who already know about him. So if you are not willing to go and let your salty quality be the means of preserving others out of corruption and death, then there is no other way in which they can be saved. It is thenceforth, he says, good for nothing, that is the salt, if it has lost its quality of saltiness. It is good for nothing except to be cast out and trodden under foot of men, to be treated as the dust of the earth, of no consequence whatsoever. So notice how then verse 13 supports what we were suggesting earlier, that the greatest of the blessings comes upon those who are willing to speak up for what they believe, even if it means to the point of suffering for their beliefs. Then in verse 14 we see a different figure of speech, but again it supports that same thesis. Ye are the light of the world, Jesus says. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel and cover it up so that it won't give any light, but rather they put it on a stand that it might illuminate the whole house, just as a city set upon a hill stands as a beacon for all those who can look up to the hill and see it. Jesus says, ye are the light of the world. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. We remember that in the book of Revelation, the seven ecclesias, or the seven churches, are referred to as the seven candlesticks, or lampstands, which is perhaps a better translation. The seven lamps which give forth their light, that others might see that light and come to it. Remember again the parable of the wise and foolish virgins. The wise virgins were marked out as those who had oil in their lamps so that they could give light, that others might see that light and come to it. Continuously through the New Testament, light then is a figure of speech for the gospel itself, without which men will walk only in darkness and come at last only to death. So again, Jesus is supporting this premise that he has stated in verses 10 through 12, that we must speak up for those things which we believe, and only thereby can we make our faith perfect, can we complete our faith. Going on then to verse 17, we move into another section, but keep in mind that in this class and in the classes to come through the week, what we're really going to be doing is building upon the basic principles that Jesus developed in verses 3 through 10. We can think of those Beatitudes, if you want to call them that, as being something like the Ten Commandments of Jesus, the building blocks or the foundation on which everything else rests, and now they're going to be developed in a greater detail. Jesus at the same time is going to talk in a negative fashion from time to time, pointing out those things which are contrary to the principles that he has mentioned in the earlier verses. And so we see a bit of both of these things as we go into the next section. First of all, there are a couple of verses, verses 17 and 18 here, which at first glance don't really appear to fit in the context. Jesus says now in verse 17, think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And immediately, when I studied this carefully, it brought to my mind the question, what was it that Jesus had said in any of these earlier verses, in any of these earlier sayings, that would ever have led men to suppose that he was seeking to destroy the law? What was it that Jesus had said that would lead men to suppose that he'd ever thought of destroying the law? And I'm not sure what the answer is. It came to me that perhaps the answer was this, and maybe there's some other better answer, but perhaps the answer was this, that when Jesus says, blessed are those who are meek, blessed are those who are poor in spirit, blessed are the merciful, blessed are the peacemakers, that perhaps his listeners had so ingrained in their minds the external, mechanical provisions of the law, that when Jesus came preaching this internal, spiritual development of the heart and the mind, that was so revolutionary that his listeners might be tempted to conclude that he was preaching an entirely different law. But we know when we looked at those passages last night, many of them taken from the Old Testament, that what Jesus was really doing was developing the essence of the meaning of the old law, because it was there all along. the commandments of the old law, thou shalt love the Lord thy God, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. But apparently, so many of his listeners, following the lead of the Pharisees, had gotten into thinking of the law as a mere body of mechanical provisions that needed to be fulfilled without regard to what goes on inside the heart. Apparently, so many people had come to think that, that Jesus assumed that they would consider his teaching revolutionary, that they would consider his teaching subversive of the law of Moses. And so he says then, and then perhaps there may be a better reason for this, but that seems to me to be reasonable at least. So he says, think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets, no matter how revolutionary this sounds. I'm not destroying the law, I'm developing the meaning of the law so that you'll understand truly what God intended from the very beginning. I'm, in a sense, extracting the essence of the law from all of this verbiage that has been piled up on top of it, all of the details about how the various sacrifices should be kept, about how man should serve God externally. I'm digging down beneath that, and I'm bringing out the principles that make sense of this body of law that you have. Think not that I am come to destroy the law. We could mention in passing that churches around us quite often do go about destroying the law altogether. And not only the law, but as Jesus says here, the law and the prophets. There are many churches today that speak of themselves and proudly as being New Testament churches, as though they had no particular regard, and they don't, for anything that was said in the Old Testament. But there's an old saying that I think is very appropriate here. The old is in the new revealed, even as the new is in the old concealed. And you have to have the two together. The Old Testament that explains and provides the foundation for the New Testament, and the New Testament that shows the fulfillment of all of the things that the Old Testament spoke of concerning salvation to be found in Christ. And the two have to come together. So Jesus had no intention of destroying the law so much as he did of fulfilling it, of providing a completion for all that the law had to say and all that the law was looking forward to. Jesus himself was the completion of all of the old covenant. He was the perfect sacrifice. He was the perfect priest. He was the rest that the law spoke of, that God had given man. Jesus said, I am the perfect rest. All the things of which the law spoke, Jesus said, I am the one who has come to complete them, to fulfill them. Notice what he says also in verse 18. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. I'd like to stop for just a moment and look at verse 18 and Jesus' reference to the jot. We'll mention the tittle for just a moment maybe if I don't forget it, but particularly the jot. I find it very interesting. And a couple of ideas here that aren't directly related to the Sermon on the Mount, but perhaps you will find interesting too. The jot was, and I'm no Hebrew scholar particularly, I just picked up a little here and there, so don't ask me any detailed questions about Hebrew, but the jot was the smallest Hebrew letter. It looks something like an apostrophe. Oh, you might turn, if you have a King James Version, one of the old-fashioned Bibles, turn over to Psalm 119. I'm not going to go into detailed explanation about why this is so, but the different sections of Psalm 119 are headed up by different Hebrew letters. And you can see an example of the jot in Psalm 119, verse 73, called Jod, J-O-D, but also could be pronounced Jot, J-O-T, or Yod, Y-O-D, and so forth. That same pronunciation. Psalm 119 and verse 73. The little mark there that looks like an apostrophe is a jot. It's almost the equivalent, even for pronunciation, to what you have in the Greek language, which is the iota. Sometimes you put a dot on top of it. And that is the Greek equivalent of I, or even perhaps of Y. Hence we have the jot or the yod, which is the smallest letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So Jesus, when he says this, is saying not even one letter as written in the law originally can be changed or can be removed until all things have been fulfilled.
The Hebrew Yod was the smallest letter of the alphabet, but it had a tremendous significance. A number of the names of the righteous men in the Old Testament were changed by God by the adding of that one small letter. If I'm not mistaken, and again, I'm doing this from memory, but Abram was changed to Abraham by the addition, I believe, of that letter. Don't hold me to that until you do your own concordance work and determine if that's true. I had this particular point that I'm going to show you here on the blackboard brought to my attention by Brother Whitaker a while back, and I found it so fascinating I thought that if I ever found any kind of a half of a reason to insert it into a class that I would do it and share it with others. The name of God, the most common name of God in the Old Testament, is Yah, or Yet, depending on how you want to pronounce it. No one's really quite sure. And it consists of two Hebrew letters. It looks something like this. And remember, in the Hebrew, you read from right to left, and so the first letter is the letter Yod. The second letter is the letter He, or He, and it's made by something that looks a bit like a door, and the mark going up on the left side doesn't quite reach the top of the door there. Let me see. That is in, if you're still in Psalm 119, it's the letter that's mentioned in, or that's shown before verse 33, the He. So those two letters together, Yod and He, spell Yah, or Yet, the name of God. Now, you say, so what? Well, perhaps the point is this, that if you didn't have the Yod, what would you have? You'd only have one letter that would be meaningless by itself. In fact, it isn't exactly meaningless, because that one letter, He, literally means a window. It's a picture letter, as the Hebrew letters were, a picture letter that means a window. And then we have the addition of the Yod in the front, and we have the name of God. Also, notice that that letter, He, looks very much like a door. Think back to what happened in the book of Exodus, as described when God was delivering the children of Israel out of Egypt. He said, you will take the blood of the Passover lamb, and we know from the New Testament that that symbolized Christ, who in his sacrifice was the perfect Passover. You will take the blood of the Passover lamb, and you will use it to mark upon the doorpost and the lintels of your doors, the houses in Egypt, so that the avenging angel will pass over you, and you will be protected. Incidentally, this little letter, Yod, literally means a hand. And so, if you look at the name of God, the shortest name of God in the New Testament, what do you see? You see a hand reaching up to put blood on the side of the door. So the means by which God redeemed his people out of Egypt is memorialized in the very name of God, the blood upon the doorposts. There is another Hebrew word. It's composed of two letters. That may not be quite in proportion, but it's composed of two letters, with the Yod coming second, and this letter is Heth. You'll find it in Psalm 119 and verse 57, Heth, or Keth. And again, it presents the same picture. In fact, this letter, notice the only real difference is it closes up at the top here rather than leaves it open. A number of the Hebrew letters look quite similar to one another. These two letters together, read from right to left as they should be, spell what we might transliterate as Chi. And you recognize that, some of you will, I'm sure, as the Hebrew word for life. This letter, the Keth, or the Keth, literally means an enclosure, like a corral if you come from Texas or the Southwest, an enclosure to protect. those who are inside. And so again, in the Hebrew word for life, with only these two letters put together, you have memorialized how God brought life to the children of Israel in Egypt. The hand reached up and put the blood upon the doorpost, and those who were protected inside the korel, or inside the encircling protection of God, who were protected by the angel, were delivered into life as they came out of Egypt. And those who were left behind, who did not have this covering protection, were put to death by the destroying angel. So, I mention that as sort of an incidental thing, and yet it illustrates, I think, what Jesus would have liked us to say, and the point that he was making in verse 18, when he says, turn back to Matthew 5 and verse 18, that not one jot of the law will pass away, that every single letter, even the smallest letter, is important. Notice how it changes the meaning of the words, whether that letter is there or not. Not one jot of the law will pass away until all be fulfilled. If we had the time, and if I knew enough, I could probably point out to you something about the tittle. I can't really say much about that, except to say that it is a little distinguishing mark to be found on the top of certain of the Hebrew letters, to distinguish one letter that looks very, very much like another letter. And sometimes a mark is put on top of one or the other as a sort of a code by which the readers will be able to distinguish between the two. Again, Jesus is referring to one of the very smallest parts of the written Hebrew language. And it seems to me the basic point to get from this is that Jesus is saying every single word, every single letter of God's revelation is tremendously important. And so we have an example here of how Jesus thinks about the inspiration of the Bible. No question but that he felt that every single verse in the Bible and every single word was inspired by God. I know we have difficulties today because of transmission and translation, but still I think that making allowances for the difficulties we have there, our belief should be the same as Jesus's, that every part of the Bible is wholly inspired and infallible. This is what Jesus thought, and certainly we should believe the same. Now, having put that aside as again, a sort of digression from the main development of his thought, we go to verse 19. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments, and the word break there in verse 19 is translated in some of the modern versions by such words as relax or loosen. So that Jesus isn't simply saying whoever will break the commandment, but even someone who will just loosen it a little bit to fit his own particular case, who will relax the law just a bit, is also guilty. Whosoever therefore shall relax one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. And that phrase does not mean that he will be in the kingdom of heaven, but it means, or the kingdom of God, the two are interchangeable, obviously, but it means he will be called least by those who are in the kingdom of heaven, or the kingdom of God, but he himself will be excluded. That seems to be the basic point of Jesus' words here. Then in verse 20, Jesus says, I say unto you, and here we have the basic premise that he's going to follow throughout the rest of the chapter, some of which we'll discuss this evening, and the rest hopefully tomorrow evening. For I say unto you, that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God. Except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Hence the title that we use this evening. Two kinds of righteousness. The righteousness that was particularly prevalent among the scribes and Pharisees, and a different kind of righteousness which should exceed their righteousness that Jesus was teaching to his followers. Two kinds of righteousness. We say two kinds of righteousness because if you think about it, the Pharisees were very fine people. They were utterly devoted toward serving God, so much so that they spent a good bit of their time discussing the technicalities of the law of Moses. how exactly one would go about fulfilling the law, and all of the different ways in which one might possibly break one of the laws. They were very devoted, very righteous in a certain sort of way. But they were devoted to the mechanics and the details of the law rather than the spirit. When Jesus says, your righteousness must exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees, if looked at from one perspective, that would be an utter impossibility. No one could exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees. They were thoroughly devoted to keeping the law. So when Jesus says, your righteousness or our righteousness should exceed theirs, he must mean a different kind of righteousness. Not hoping to exceed the Pharisees in their punctilious regard for every little detail, because they had a head start for many, many years and traditions built up, but rather go in a different direction and let your righteousness exceed theirs. So Jesus is talking about two different kinds of righteousness. And as we go through the rest of chapter 5, we begin to get an impression of what those two kinds of righteousness are. He now starts upon a series of contrasts, beginning with verse 21. And just notice through the rest of chapter 5 how these contrasts go. There is one stock expression that Jesus uses in verse 21 and verse 27 and verse 31 and so forth right through the chapter. And that is, ye have heard that it was said by them of old time. So here is one kind of righteousness. And he always introduces it by this phrase, you have heard it said by those of old time, or something that's a slight variation of that perhaps. One kind of righteousness, the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. And then the second kind of righteousness, which always invariably follows the first to contrast the two, we find in verse 22, verse 23, verse 34, and so forth to the end of the chapter. And this second kind of righteousness invariably begins, but I say unto you. So Jesus is contrasting two different things. Keep in mind, he's not contrasting the law of Moses with the law of Christ, because he just finished saying, I have not come to destroy the law, I have come to fulfill it. He is instead contrasting two different ways of approaching the law. The Pharisees' way and his own way, which is obviously the correct way. You have heard it said, such and such, but I say unto you, such and such. Now, we'll see as we go through some of these this evening that the first portion of what Jesus has to say invariably precedes a quotation from the law of Moses, sometimes a misquotation, sometimes a misapplication of the law of Moses, and then he says, but I say unto you, and he gives the true principle in a deeper and more spiritual application than the Pharisees ever thought of. So what Jesus is really saying is, get down beneath the surface and try to understand what God wanted to teach you by that particular law that was given. So Jesus is not giving a new law, a revolutionary new beginning, but rather he's giving the correct understanding of the old law, the law of Moses, from the very beginning. He's giving it a new thrust, a new direction, a new incentive in his own life by his own example. It's as if he is saying, if you want to know what the law of Moses was really about, look at me. I am the embodiment. I am the fulfillment of the law of Moses. And so I think we can rightly say that true Christianity is true Judaism. It is the true understanding of the law as those things are fulfilled in Christ. So we look at the first example, verses 21 and 22. Keep in mind the two kinds of righteousness. You have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. In this case, a very straightforward statement of one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. No problem with that. But I say unto you, and in this case we see Jesus is amplifying the law, showing the true intention of the law, when he says, whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And I think we shouldn't put much stress upon that phrase, without a cause. In fact, some of the manuscripts don't even have it there. But rather, Jesus is saying we shouldn't be angry with our brother. Just as he is saying, whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, in other words, you fool or you vain fellow, shall be in danger of the council, and whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire, which is Gehenna, the judicial fire of judgment that would consume the bodies of the criminals in Israel. So, notice the principle here that Jesus is laying out. He isn't saying it is wrong to say, thou shalt not kill. Obviously, that was a true law. What Jesus is saying is, let's look behind the external act and understand the motivation. That murder invariably is developed out of some kind of hatred. And so, if you want to be on the right, in effect, you cannot approach to God in prayer through me unless you have purged your heart of the hatred and the bitterness that leads you to be at odds with your brother. A very striking sort of commandment. But notice, as I said earlier, much of what Jesus says is an amplification of those Beatitudes at the very beginning. And what he said at the very beginning was, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. And blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. So, he is amplifying and explaining what he stated at the very beginning as he gives the examples here, almost in the form of a parable for us to understand what he meant. And he's showing that the sort of understanding of the law that the Pharisees kept so well falls a mile short of where they should be. Because by their standard, looking only at the letter of the law, it's perfectly permissible to hate your brother and to plot all kinds of evil against him, just so long as you don't quite carry it out. And you can enjoy yourself immensely imagining his discomfort or what you would do to him if you had a chance. But you just don't do it, you see, and then you're safe. No one can judge you as having violated the law. And yet look at yourself in that sort of condition. You're a mess. You're living two lives. Externally, you're being obedient and righteous as you keep the law, and no one would know. But internally, your heart is filled with corruption and wickedness. So Jesus says, go to the root of the matter and change it there. You see, two kinds of righteousness. The one kind that might look good on the surface, but as Jesus says in Matthew 23, like a whited sepulcher, inside there is nothing but dead men's bones and corruption. So change what is inside as well as what is outside. Be reconciled to your brother. Now I mentioned here a quotation that you might be interested in because it was something Brother Nichols said in an article some time ago, and I understand Brother Nichols was here a week or two ago. Brother Nichols said, in regard to this verse, brethren in Christ must practice reconciliation and unity, not seeking to expose sins, but to restore the sinner, not driving wedges, but building bridges, not rejoicing more over one sheep that is lost than over the one sheep that is found. Be reconciled to your brother. Verses 25 and 26, still developing this basic statement of Jesus. Notice it's still in that same section. You have heard it said, but I say unto you. We haven't gone into the second section like that as yet. So verses 25 and 26 read as follows. Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing. Roman law gave the creditor the right to go and take the debtor, grab him by the arm, so to speak, and lead him away to the judge to have their case decided, to haul him into court and settle this debt before a judge so that he would be forced to pay. Presumably, if he was past due in making his payments. I don't assume that he could do that any time he pleased. Jesus is saying here that God is the adversary, or God can become your adversary. So agree with him as quickly as possible. And I'm not saying it doesn't have a more mundane application, but I think that that's part of what Jesus is saying here. When he says, God is your adversary, you owe him a debt, so do what you can to pay that debt before he calls it to your account. And in saying this, he's again going back to that beatitude or that blessing. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Jesus develops later a whole parable out of this when he tells the parable or the story of the man who was owed just a little bit of money. I forget the exact particulars. And, excuse me, that was backwards, wasn't it? The man who owed a great debt, and he found that debt forgiven. And the next thing we see him doing, he turns right around and he goes out to his neighbor who owes him just a little bit of money, and he pounds the table and he threatens him until that man pays. And Jesus tells this parable as if to say, this is not the way to behave. You have been forgiven many things. You have been forgiven a great debt. Now, be prepared to forgive others. And so the way in which we can agree with God, to whom we owe a great deal, is we should be prepared to forgive others. And that will, in a sense, settle our debt with God. Settle with God before it is too late. Isaiah says something very similar to this in a couple of places. Isaiah 1 and verse 18, when he says, come now and let us reason together. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Come to God and reason with him. Settle your debts with God. And the way we do that is by forgiving others. You see, even in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus is saying the same thing. When he teaches men how to pray, Matthew 6 and verse 12, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. So the only way we can expect our adversary, in this case God, to forgive the debt that we owe him is we have to be prepared to forgive the debts that others owe us. And Jesus makes this quite plain when he finishes the prayer in verse 14 by saying, if ye forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. Now, I'm not saying that verses 25 and 26 don't have a more practical meaning, but I'm simply saying that in this context, and considering what Jesus has said earlier, we can put that application upon it. All right. The second such contrast between the two kinds of righteousness begins with verse 27. See how the pattern follows and repeats itself. You have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. Notice how we have the same pattern all over again. The Pharisee could be perfectly righteous in keeping the law by simply refraining from the outward act of adultery, while harboring in his heart any number of lustful thoughts, and perhaps enjoying those thoughts greatly. Jesus says, this is not nearly enough. You must change your heart as well as your actions. And so again, his law goes deeper. His law is broader in application than the simple, straightforward statement of the law of Moses. Brother Peter Watkins said one time, if a brother who looks lustfully is an adulterer in his heart, then a sister who dresses or acts provocatively is a harlot in her heart. And I think in saying that, we give equal time to both sexes in the matter. There is the intention, there is the thought that might never find expression in action, and yet the thought itself, Jesus says, is a great sin and a great corrupting influence. Control the thoughts, replace the thoughts with thoughts of righteousness, and then the actions will take care of themselves. A deeper and broader application, a different kind of righteousness that Jesus is stating. Verses 29 and 30, following on with the thoughts expressed in verse 28, if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that the whole body should be cast into hell, or Gehenna. I think that we shouldn't have any difficulty with this. Obviously, Jesus is speaking in a figurative way, but he is speaking with such strong, outright language because he wants us to see how important the principle is. If there's anything in your life that would lead you astray from God, then get rid of it, whatever it might be, even to cutting off your hand. And again, it's a hyperbole, it's an exaggeration. If a man were to cut off one hand, he could still do great sins with the other hand. And I don't think Jesus is saying that so much as he's saying, whatever it is, don't let anything stand in your way from serving God. Be ruthless in removing from your lives those things that would keep you from serving God. Verses 31 and 32. This is not the last contrast, but it's perhaps the last one we'll talk about this evening, and we'll continue the same kind of discussion of the two kinds of righteousness tomorrow. Because, obviously, this same arrangement of Jesus' sermon continues to the end of chapter 5, if you'll notice the verses ahead. But we look at verses 31 and 32. It hath been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you, that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving or except for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery. Now, I know some of you think I'm pretty young. All depends on your point of view. Some of you probably think I'm pretty old. But I've been around for a while. I spent a lot of time with Christadelphians, and I know that these are some of the verses that can provoke more arguments and discussions long into the night and into the next morning of any of the verses in the Bible. So it would be prudent, at least, and I'm going to try to be prudent, to preface anything I say here with the suggestion that this is only the way I look at it. It isn't something that I'm trying to force upon anyone else, but I'm going to try to explain these verses as I see them, compatible with what I understand to be the basic point that Jesus is following and developing in Matthew chapter 5. There may be a lot more to be said. I might seem rather inadequate to some of you who have very well-developed ideas on these verses, and I apologize ahead of time. I can probably be saved by the fact that I shouldn't go on for more than 4 or 5 minutes, so I'll be able to get off before I get myself in too much trouble. But let me just keep in mind, and let you keep in mind, what we've been describing already about the two different kinds of righteousness, and then we see how these verses fit into that. I'm not going to be able to follow up on all the possible ramifications of divorce and remarriage as discussed by Christadelphians, but let's leave that for the time being. In verse 31, Jesus says, you have heard the Pharisees say, because that's the point, that's this contrast that we're developing, by their standard of righteousness, that a man can put away his wife by giving her a writing of divorcement. And apparently, the Pharisees were basing this upon Deuteronomy chapter 24, which said, and I'm not going to bother turning it up, but those of you who are familiar with it will know what I'm talking about, and the rest of you probably can let it go and you won't be too much harmed. In Deuteronomy 24, Moses says to the children of Israel that if a man finds some matter of uncleanness, that's the way it's translated in the King James Version, that he can give his wife a bill of divorcement and send her away, and she can go and marry someone else. Now, apparently, that statement, if a man finds a matter of uncleanness, that statement was expanded, sort of like an umbrella provision, by the Pharisees to include any sort of dissatisfaction that a husband might have with his wife. If she didn't cook the meals correctly, if she spoke to him the wrong way, he could use that verse as an excuse, because that's really what it was. Pharisees didn't say so, but that's what it was. He could use that verse as an excuse to be rid of a wife that he may not have wanted any longer. And that's the basic point. Deuteronomy 24, however, that passage that we just referred to, when it says a man would find a matter of uncleanness, that phrase, matter of uncleanness, I think I'm quoting it correctly, is literally, in the Hebrew, a word of nakedness. And nakedness in the law was quite often used as a euphemism, a polite expression for a sexual sin, whether it be adultery or fornication or homosexuality or incest or whatever. Remember the passages about thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of such and such a person, and so forth. So, Jesus seems to be pointing out in verse 32 when he says, but I say unto you, the true understanding of what that law in Deuteronomy 24 was, and therefore developing it and presenting it to his followers as the course of action that they should take. But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for or except for the cause of fornication. So he was limiting what the Pharisees were using as a wide blanket application so that they could divorce their wives for any number of causes and find some kind of justification for it in the law. Jesus was replacing that by a correct statement of what the law said, that a man should not divorce his wife except for the cause, and that word cause is logos, or logos, the word of fornication. So when Jesus says the word of fornication, he is making that exactly equivalent with Deuteronomy 24, which said literally the word of nakedness. And he's explaining that the nakedness referred to in Deuteronomy 24 refers to fornication. And again, we talk about fornication, it means, or it seems to me, some scholars have said this, and I'm not an expert in the matter, but it has been suggested it means any kind of sexual sin, whether it be what we would commonly call fornication, or adultery, or incest, or homosexuality, and so forth. Jesus is saying this is the only possible reason for a man to put away his wife. I'm not even going to enter into the possibility of whether or not that might be reversed as regards the woman. That's another matter altogether. There is another contrast that Jesus makes, and for that we probably should look for just one moment at Matthew chapter 19, where he gets into the same business once again. Matthew chapter 19 and verse 8. It's made plainer here, but I think it's implicit in what he says in Matthew chapter 5 as well. Matthew 19. Now the question is where to start. Let's just start with verse 3 and we'll read it quickly. The Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him and saying unto him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? You see, that's the equivalent of Matthew 5 and verse 31. If a man wants to put away his wife, let him give her a bill of divorcement. He can put her away. He can find any reason he pleases. That seems to be what the Pharisees were getting at least one school of thought among the Pharisees. And so they came to him, taking up this matter again. Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And he answered and said unto them, and here he goes back to the very beginning, the principle established in the Garden of Eden. Have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. Therefore, they are no more two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder. So there's the basic premise on which Jesus builds everything, that marriage should be indissoluble. They say unto him, why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement? And there's the second point, you see, that was implicit in Matthew 5. You see, the Pharisees were saying, Moses commanded us to do this. We should do it if we're dissatisfied to whatever these reasons are. Jesus says, no, it wasn't a command. And here he's talking about the law of Moses, but he's also talking about his own law. It isn't a command to put away your wife for any reason, even for adultery. It is not a command. Moses gave you this law, verse 8. Moses suffered you to do this. It was not a command. It was an allowance. He let you do it, but only for a very restricted reason. And only, where is that in here? In verse 8, only because of the hardness of your heart. So again, Jesus is reasserting that the ideal is one marriage, not to be dissolved for any reason, and that unfaithfulness should, if possible, be forgiven. But for the hardness of your hearts, Moses permitted you to put away your wives, but only for that one reason. And if anything, as we apply the words of Moses filtered through Jesus to the New Testament, the only possible reason, it seems to me, therefore, for divorce would be adultery. And even then, not as a command, but only as a permission. And that seems to be what Jesus has in mind here. So Jesus was reinforcing the Mosaic permission, not a command, which had been very cleverly broadened by the Pharisees to include all sorts of things. Jesus was narrowing it down to the place where it belonged and emphasizing that it was a permission and not a command, and that there was only, as we said, one reason, one possible reason for doing so. Notice also, while we're in Matthew 19, verse 9, and I say unto you, see how that's a pattern that he was using in Matthew 5 as well. But I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, that same phrase that you see in Matthew 5, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. So there are two things that Jesus states here. Whosoever will put away his wife and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And it seems to me, the point, leaving aside the accepted clause one way or the other, the point that Jesus is making here is, if a man puts away his wife, and I think it might apply equally from the other side of the picture, if a man or a woman puts away his or her mate with the intention or with the purpose, whether stated or unstated, of marrying someone else, then the person who does that is guilty of adultery. And the person who does that, who puts away his wife, for example, even if he has a valid reason, but he uses it as an excuse, as a cloak for the intention in his heart, which is adultery, like Jesus already stated in Matthew 5 and verse 28, then he is committing adultery, because the intention is there, whether or not it takes form in action. And so we say that, and here we could talk hypothetically about all sorts of situations, and I'm not going to try. But it seems to me, in keeping with the basic pattern that Jesus is developing in Matthew 5, what he's saying is, it isn't the external act that is sin only, but the true sin arises in the heart, in the desires. And so a man might publicly have every reason to put away his wife, every correct reason, that is, and he might exercise that reason, but he might be doing it for entirely the wrong intention, He might be doing it so that he can marry someone else. And then we're back into a position of talking about verse 28. We fall back on verse 28, as Jesus said, "Whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart." And Jesus was contrasting his righteousness with the righteousness of the Pharisees. The Pharisee would find some technical way of satisfying what he wanted to do all along. He would cloak it in a covering of the law, and he would make himself seem righteous in doing whatever he wanted to do. But Jesus said that's not good enough. Somebody, somewhere, is going to judge the heart. And the heart is where you should look for the lust that leads to sin. Now, having said all that, we have to point out also that no one can judge the intentions of the heart, can they? No one can judge the intentions of the heart except Christ. And we're still back in a position of having great difficulty in judging our brother's motives. And should we even be particularly interested in judging the motives of one another? But Christ can judge the motives of the individual. And so then, though there are other similar phrases to be considered, we'll leave those until tomorrow evening. And we conclude then by characterizing these two different kinds of righteousness. You have heard it said by them of old time, on the one hand, but I say unto you, on the other hand. The one kind of righteousness, the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, was a counterfeit righteousness. It observed only the letter of the law. It wasn't interested in the spirit. It was interested only in the external fulfillment of a particular law. It took the position that if you could determine exactly what the law was, and if you could get just one step on the right side of it, then you were fine. No matter what you thought in your heart, no matter what else you did, if you were just at one step on the right side of the law, everything would be fine. And at the same time, you could enjoy yourself immensely talking about all the details and all the technicalities of the law and make yourself righteous by what you appeared to know. And again, you could have great fun as you meticulously kept the law in judging all of those poor, miserable people who didn't quite keep the law up to your standard. Jesus says that is righteousness of a kind, but it's a counterfeit righteousness. By contrast, the righteousness that Jesus was exhorting us to was the true righteousness that considers the intention of the commandment, that tries to stay as far on the right side of the commandment as possible, that tries to understand what the principle of the commandment meant in the first place, and examine one's heart as well as one's actions to be in conformity with that commandment. And at the same time, true righteousness understands that it is in need of forgiveness and is willing to forgive others and to be reconciled with others. It doesn't need to compare itself with others, because true righteousness recognizes that all of us fail and all of us are in need of forgiveness. And so true righteousness is willing to forgive others who are coming short, just as I am coming short. So there you have it, and I think we'll amplify it even further tomorrow, the two kinds of righteousness that Jesus is describing in the Sermon on the Mount.
With the singing of hymn 258, taken from the words of Isaiah, expanding on the ideas of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. "O ye that thirst, approach the spring where living waters flow, free to that sacred fountain all without a price may go." In 258. Thank you.
Thank you.